cook slow fast. Always passes on the butter pack. She's regimented, resolute. Looks dang good in her birthday suit. She wishes I would walk the line, but most of the time I don't. She treats her body like a temple, and I treat mine like a home.
Jiminy Jog, there's old Confederate Railroad, one of my favorite bands. One thing pisses me off, though, they don't come up here in Yankee Land and play. I haven't found a date for them up here since I've been back here in Indiana. They don't seem like they want to come up north of the Mason-Dixon line. Yeah, she treats her body like a temple, and I treat mine like a, well... We won't go into that. It is the 4th of December, 2015, boys and girls. Don't forget to get your subscriptions or your donations in for the radio show. Spread the word around about the radio show. And then once you send in a donation, well, go on up there to resist.com and get educated. We need to educate the people. That's right. We don't have enough education. That song went out to the She-Wolves this morning, Freya's Day. That's right, we always keep Friday for the ladies. Oh, and guess what I heard? They're going to let the women be in every area of the military. Well, I don't know why they think that's going to be a great thing, because when you wave women in front of those Arabs over there, or those jihadists. That's a big insult to those jihadists. And see, if they're going to put a lot of women on the front lines, you're going to see a lot of women raped and tortured. And they will, and ISIS gets a hold of those women. Somehow it seems like it's almost a plan by the military-industrial complex to cause more problems. There's plenty of places off the front lines that women can serve. I think women are the best in intelligence. Spies. I watched an old film the other night, The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, with, what's his name? Married to Elizabeth Taylor. I had it right on the tip of my tongue, and there it went, off into Neverland. I'm going to give you a little bit of trivia, too. You've heard this thing about paying through the nose. You probably heard that all your life. You don't know where that came from, probably. Well, one of the Norse Viking kings had a population of another country as vassals and was bleeding them dry with taxes. And if he caught one that hadn't paid his taxes, he'd take a knife and split his nose right down the middle, or maybe cut his nose off completely. So that's where that came from, paying through the nose. Do you realize that almost all our problems in the Western world have emanated from religion or oil? Think about it. Yeah, it sounded like a good deal in the beginning. It gave us a real jump start on technology and all that kind of good stuff, having all that oil. But really, has it been that good for us? No, because we had to depend on the Middle East to get that oil. And that's where major problems of the world and then major problems of religion come out of there, the Abrahamic religions. So you can chalk it all up to that. Major problems in the Western world. If we'd have kept with steam power and windmill power and all of that kind of stuff and not needed that Middle Eastern oil, we'd be in a hell of a lot better shape. Even if our lifestyle wasn't so hot, it would have been much better than what came out of it. Boy, the fear machine is in high gear. Man, it's going like mad. Every television, every radio station, every newspaper, all of them. Spreading that fear, fear, fear. Homeland Security needs more money. They're going to double their budget now. You wait and see. They finally figured out that these people might be connected to ISIS out there in California. Military-industrial complex hit the jackpot now. You're not only going to have a super war budget for Middle East, you're going to have a super war budget for Homeland Security because they're everywhere. Run and hide, man. They're coming. ISIS is on the way. Some of those guys over there in the Middle East must be laughing their ass off. Well, these people don't know what terror is. They don't know what nature's terror is. So let's go back to The Pessimist's Guide to History. Yeah. And see what it's really like when it gets tough. 1657, Tokyo Fire. Thousands of highly inflammable wooden structures and a year of drought created ideal conditions for a massive fire in Tokyo, capital of Japan's ruling shoguns. Legend has it that the fire started when a priest attempted to burn a kimono cursed with bad luck. Whatever its cause, a small fire that began in February was whipped into a massive wall of flames by gale force winds. Flames swept through the house, from house to house, across Tokyo's narrow streets, raging south and east for 2 days while consuming houses, temples, palaces, and shops. Then a sudden wind shift drove the flames back toward the center of the city and the shogun's castle. Thousands of people perished in the flames. I bet you there was a lot more died in that fire than it did the atomic bomb. They were either trapped by the advancing fire or trampled by stampeding crowds. After 3 days, the flames died out, but smoke still darkened the ruined city. Snow began to fall. The homeless survivors then faced cold and famine, which would kill many of them. Overall, some 100,000 people perished in the calamity. The priest was right. The kimono was bad luck. So that just shows you that combined Nagasaki and Hiroshima, I don't think both of them together killed that many people. I may be mistaken. I'll have to recheck my figures. Yeah. Well, here's another good one. 1665 A.D. Great Plague of London. In 1664, London was a bustling city of some 500,000 citizens. But by September of 1665, one could walk down deserted streets at midday and see house after house boarded up, marked with red crosses and the prayer, "Lord, have mercy on us." Such was the devastation wrought by an outbreak of bubonic plague that began almost unnoticed in outlying communities near the city in December 1664. The approach of warm spring weather increased the numbers of people suddenly began to feel feverish and nauseous, and then discovered the hard, swollen, purplish spots on their bodies that characterized the Black Death. Carried by fleas on rats, the disease spread rapidly through overcrowded slums along the narrow streets, where the residents drank foul water and lived without proper sanitation facilities. By royal order, houses suspected of being infected by the plague were locked, and the occupants were virtually held prisoners within. Some of these unfortunate souls resorted to desperate measures to escape, and the watchman posted outside the door of a locked house was sometimes attacked with a sword or a pistol. At night, one could hear the sound of the handbell and a man shouting, "Bring out your dead," as the dead carts roamed the city gathering corpses. The bodies were dumped into huge pits outside the city, and one contained over 1,100 bodies before it was covered over. Wealthier citizens, including the king himself, fled to the countryside. But poorer citizens leaving the city were attacked by villagers fearing the contagion. By the time the plague abated the following winter, about 100,000 people had died. The good news is that though this was the worst plague, it was also the last. That cleaned up the gene pool real fast, man. Stuff you read in this book makes the problems of today seem very simple. It makes even ISIS seem like a Boy Scout troop. You know, all the guns and ammo that these people had when they wiped out those people in San Bernardino were all legally purchased. Now what are you going to do? You either got to say, turn all the guns in, or don't turn any guns at all in. What are they going to do? Because it doesn't make any difference if they're all legal weapons. Yeah. Well, here's the latest from the Hollywood Klan down in Irving, Texas. Protests have become the norm lately in front of a mosque in Irving, Texas. It's deeply disturbing to think that anyone in this day and age would be protesting in such a way, said Pastor Michael Waters of Joy Tabernacle, AME Church in Dallas. Everybody wants some publicity out of this thing. A screenshot was sent to the WFAA showing a post from the Texas Rebel Knights. The Knights are a white supremacist Christian group. The post calls for a rally at the mosque on December 12th. What are they going to do? Pete Evans is the Trinity Foundation in Dallas. He's part of a group that investigates churches for fraud and has heard of a fringe Christian group like the Texas Rebel Knights. They are a reflection of what's going on with ISIS, Evans said. Waters is now part of a planned counter-rally being organized on Facebook. Nearly 400 people representing many faith groups have already agreed to attend. It will be held on the same day and at the same location. Quote, they have a right to speak. Well, that's nice of you. And they have a right to free speech, the pastor said. We have the right to represent our solidarity with love. What does that mean? They love the mosque or what? WFAA reached out to the Rebel Knights, but they did not respond. Evans said he has investigated similar white supremacist Christian groups. The apostles of the early church wouldn't recognize this group as being any more Christian than my toenail. Well, they'd recognize it as being more Jewish than anything else. The post promoting the original rally appears to have been removed. Irving police said they are aware of the planned rallies and told the WFAA that they are monitoring the situation. They got every informant in town checking up on these guys. Whether the Rebel Knights show up in 2 weeks from now, Pastor Waters said the counter rally is still on. We're supporting our Muslim brothers. Saturday will be peaceful. Saturday will be a righteous revolution, he said. Well, there's a little mention of your the Ku Klux Klan. You deserve to know. The guy on the web asked, I read a blog by artist and writer Rhett Jones asking, quote, why isn't the KKK designated as a terrorist organization? Question mark. Good question. Well, I would say if they were designated a terrorist organization, they could get all the weapons they want. You know, that's how ISIS got the weapons. The U.S. government gave it to them. So the Klan, if you get branded as a terrorist organization, they'll arm you to the teeth. Well, here's more about the Negro shakedown. And the shakedown continues. San Francisco, while Microsoft's annual shareholder meeting Wednesday was largely a platform for executives to repeat the company's mobile and cloud-first mantra, the lengthy question and answer session that followed dove into the thorny topics of racism and ageism. Leading off the questions at Microsoft's campus in Redmond, Washington, was Reverend Jesse Jackson, whose Rainbow Push Coalition has been hammering tech companies for years about the lack of diversity and payoffs to them. After congratulating CEO Satya Nadella on the pending appointment of two new female board members, Johnson & Johnson's Sandra Peterson and former Cisco CTO Padmasree Warrior, she's obviously an Indian, he pushed the company to add black and Latino members next because Microsoft can lead. Microsoft's board chairman, John Thompson, is an African American. He and Nadella met privately with Jackson on Tuesday to discuss the shakedown. It's not just about words, it's robust action and having a rich dialogue about having a culture of inclusiveness, which means more niggas. Negrophilia and more Negroes, which was agreed during the meeting, which was webcast. He noted that it had run 100,000 employees through new unconscious bias training. Oh, you better not say the wrong words in there, referring to the private conversation he had with the civil wrongs leader earlier. Nadella said he would look into new areas suggested by Jackson, specifically ethnic representation in advertising, as well as location of more corporate resources to reach those in the inner city. Well, if you notice commercial advertising lately, it's almost all Negroes. Some Mexicans, some Orientals, but the ads are absolutely crawling with Negro pictures and black men with white women or black men with very light black-complected women. I hope you've noticed that. They put all kinds of white people out of business. Beautiful white women that could be doing ads. I don't think there's half what they were even a couple of years ago. So in the advertising business, they're pushing non-whites to the fore, especially blacks, as fast as they can. It's your jobs, Whitey. You going to fight for them or not? No, you're not going to fight for them, because you would never be caught dead being called a racist or a white supremacist. In September, Nadella announced Microsoft would spend $75 million over the next 3 years to get black kids interested in technology. Through the TEALS program, Technology Education and Literacy in Schools. On a more disappointing note, the company released employee diversity numbers last week that indicated its racial and gender makeup remains essentially unchanged, mostly white and male, echoing most other tech companies, with a notable drop in female employees as a result of the Nokia layoffs. That said, Jesse Jackson is optimistic that Microsoft under Nadella will continue to remake itself to reflect the Negro workers, more workers from the Negro people. They're talking more and more leadership on this issue, and at least it's all in clear view and they're not avoiding the subject, Jesse Jackson told the USA Today after the meeting adjourned. He said he was impressed that the four executives on stage at the meeting, including a Negro American by the name of Thompson, one female, CF Amy Hood, one Asian, Nadella, and one white person, President Brad Smith. There you go. That reminds me of that joke I heard where he said, whites don't have to play basketball. They own the team. When are there going to be any white people that show up at these things and speak? All you have to do is buy yourself one share of General Motors or whatever it is, and allegedly you have a right to speak at these get-togethers, and nobody does. So we give the field to the Negroes. Let Jesse Jackson dictate. At least Dr. Pierce used to get in on these get-togethers and say what he had to say. You only had to buy, I think, one or two shares. Well, here's a switch. Elizabeth, New Jersey, a recent Keene College graduate, has been charged with being responsible for a series of threats threatening black students at the school 2 weeks ago, acting Union County Prosecutor Grace H. Park announced Tuesday. Kayla Simone McKelvey, 24, of Union, a black alumnus who graduated in May, was charged by summons with third degree, creating a false public alarm. Park said an investigation by the Union County Prosecutor's Office, Special Prosecution Unit, and Keene University Police found McKelvey, a self-proclaimed activist, participating in a student rally to raise awareness of racism on college campuses on November 17th, but left midway through and walked to a computer station in a university library. Well, then what did she do? Don't hold back, Tommy. Get to it here. You're losing your audience. Once there, McKelvey allegedly created an anonymous Twitter account, Keen Against BLK, and began posting threats of violence against black Keen students. The first message around 10 p.m. said Keen University Twitter against blacks is for everyone who hates black people, and a tweet about there being a bomb on the campus, and then continued with several other tweets about shooting black students at the university. So you see there, if you don't have any racism or any violence threats from white people, blacks are dreaming up threats themselves. How about that? Well, well, run for your lives. There's racism in Mexico City. A Coca-Cola advertisement has caused a furor in Mexico. As an indigenous group said Wednesday, the images of young white people building a Christmas tree in its community had racist connotations. But the U.S. company said the spot's message was misinterpreted. Coca-Cola pulled the ad from social media websites late Tuesday after complaints emerged over the images. Can't have those white people on that TV! Human rights organizations and members of the Mi'kmaq indigenous group called on the government's National Council to Prevent Discrimination to sanction the U.S. soft drink company over the ad. The ad shows the white youth driving to the village of Tontonpeca in southern Oaxaca State, bringing a cooler of Coca-Cola and building a Christmas tree made of the red top bottles under the theme, Let's Stay United. Well, that's really racist, boy, I'll tell you. Something else. I think I mentioned some of this before to you. For almost a century, there was a comforting American narrative that went like this. Advances in nutrition and medical care would guarantee longer lives for all. Recently, published research, however, shows that the members of the white working class, boy, that's something you hardly ever see, ages 45 to 54 are dying at an immoderate rate. In the last 4 years, the lifespan gap between the poor white men, get that, poor white men, and wealthier ones has widened up to 4 years. This was not supposed to happen, especially not to white people, who in relation to people of color have long had the advantage of higher earnings, better access to health care, safer neighborhoods, and, of course, freedom from daily insults, harms inflicted on the darker skin. Well, that's too bad. There has long been a racial gap in longevity, 5.3 years between white and black men, 3.8 between white and black women. Though hardly noticed, it has been narrowing since the mid-1990s, but now it is whites who are dying off in unexpectedly large numbers in middle age. Deaths accounted for by suicide, alcoholism, and drug addiction. Well, why? Because they've got no work. Jobs have been shipped out of the country, and blacks many times are given preference over whites. There may be some practical reasons why some white people have gotten more efficient at killing themselves. For one thing, whites are more likely than blacks to be gun owners, and white men favor gunshots as a means of suicide. For another, doctors undoubtedly, acting in part on stereotypes of non-whites as drug addicts, may be more likely to prescribe powerful opiate painkillers to whites than to people of color when manual labor from waitressing to construction work wears down knees, backs, and rotator cuffs. But something more profound is going on here, too. The New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, who you can't trust, puts it, the diseases leading to excess white working class deaths are those of despair. I grew up in an America where a man with a strong back, and better yet, a strong union, could reasonably expect to support a family without a college degree. In 2015, those jobs are long gone, leaving only the kind of work once relegated to women and people of color. Those at the bottom 20% of the white income distribution face material circumstances like those long familiar to poor blacks, including erratic employment and crowded, hazardous living spaces. White privilege was never, however, simply a matter of economic advantage, as W.E.B. Du Bois wrote in 1935, who was a communist. It must be remembered that the white group of laborers, while they received low wage, were compensated in part by a sort of public and psychological wage. He was talking about admission to public schools, spaces, and functions. Today, at least legally speaking, all of that is open to all. But as blacks have made gains in the de jure since, whites have lost ground economically as a result, the psychological wage awarded to white people has been shrinking. And they haven't done a goddamn thing about it either, except vote for Republicans. You deserve what you get, Whitey. For most of the American history, government could be counted on to maintain white power and privilege by enforcing slavery and later segregation. When the federal government finally weighed in on the side of desegregation, working class whites were left to defend their diminishing privilege. The culture, too, has inched towards racial equality, if to stock moronic derogatory image of the early 20th century Negro was a minstrel, the role of rural simpleton has been taken over in this century by the Duck Dynasty, and here comes Honey Boo Boo. It's not easy to maintain the usual sense of white superiority when the entertainment world is squeezing laughs from the contrast between savvy blacks and rural white bumpkins, as in the new Tina Fey comedy Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Then, of course, there was the election of the first black president. Among some white native-born Americans, there was talk of taking our country back. The more affluent ones formed the Tea Party. Less affluent ones would choose to affix a Confederate flag decal on their truck, rather than pick up a gun and start a civil war. All of this means that the maintenance of white privilege, especially among the least privileged whites, has become more difficult, and so for some more urgent than ever, right down to perpetuating the microaggressions that royal college campuses, the racial slurs yelled from pickup trucks, or a deadly extreme, the shooting up of a black church renowned for its efforts in the civil wrongs area. Dylan Roof of Charleston, South Carolina, killer who did just that, was a jobless high school dropout and reportedly a heavy user of alcohol and opiates. Even without a death sentence for the killings hanging over him, Roof was surely headed towards an early demise. Although there is no medical evidence that racism is toxic to those who express it, after all, generations of wealthy slave owners survived quite nicely. The combination of downward mobility and racial resentment may be a potent invitation to the kind of despair that leads to an increase in white working class deaths, to suicide in one form or another, whether by gunshots or drugs. You can't break a glass ceiling if you're standing on ice. It may be easy to feel righteous disgust for the lower class white racism, and no less easy to feel noble for acknowledging the economic and psychological misery of the white working class. But Americans higher up the ladder are in trouble too, with diminishing prospects facing adults and the young. Whole professions have fallen on hard times, from college teaching to journalism and the law. One of the worst mistakes this relative elite could make is to try to pump up its own pride by hating on those of any color, of any ethnicity, who are on the downward slope and falling even faster. Well, the woman who wrote this was Barbara Ehrenreich. I like that. Ehrenreich is the founder and editor of Economic Hardship Reporting Project. There you go. A longer version of this essay is at tom.dispatch.com. Forget that address. It doesn't come up. You can't get anything there. I don't know what's wrong with that. This big push on black matters, blacks matter, is a second tsunami, big tsunami that started in the mid-60s. They're coming at us again with another tsunami of anti-racism, or so-called, not anti-racism, pro-black racism. And so, get ready. It's a tidal wave, and I don't think the whites are up to doing anything about it. And you can't depend at all on political parties to change things. The only thing I can see is this this empire deteriorates and the non-whites get bolder and bolder and bolder, only then will there be opportunity to turn it around. Not until then. It's too bad because we have the people, we have the bodies, but their minds are so screwed up they can't get it straight. And they're going to ride this horse right down to the end. But there is an end, and then it's going to be hell to pay. Mark my word. Well, guess what's going on in Israel, boys and girls? Nitwit is encouraging everybody in Israel to carry a gun and be armed. How about that? But here in the U.S., most liberal Jews are trying to get rid of our guns.
Take them guns away from those white boys. They're liable to give us trouble, man.
The mayor of Jerusalem urged gun owners to carry their weapons at all times on Thursday in the wake of a slew of attacks and unrest in Israel and the West Bank. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has urged citizens to be on maximum alert after a wave of stabbings, shootings, and clashes. Also on Thursday, according to a government official, Netanyahu barred all Jewish and Arab lawmakers from visiting the sensitive holy site in Jerusalem in an effort to stop recent street violence from spiraling further.
Now let's talk about Sam Bernardino here. About the San Bernardino spectacle. As usual, the news media asked no intelligent questions. One, were there no security people at the complex of this size? Two, where is the surveillance camera footage? No cameras anywhere. Really? Where did all those cops come from so fast? It looked like the staging for the invasion of Normandy. All that was missing were jet flyovers and a mobile donut shop. None of the people on stretchers showed any signs of blood. So what was their problem exactly? Generally, people who've been shot bleed, at least a little. The one guy who did have a little blood on his shirt looked like it was smeared in totally random places. The usual suspects, Obama, Clinton, and so on, were on TV instantly denouncing guns. If the killers used meat cleavers, would they be denouncing them too? A married couple with 6 months old did this. Are you serious? If that's the way it really happened, this is an unprecedented 1 in 10 billion case of serious mental illness, which nothing can defend against. Mediate on the strangeness of this story. What mother on earth with a 6 month old baby would decide now is the time to play psycho commando with my husband? Now, let's see here. The shooters were masked and described by one early witness as big and brawny. How do we know that the police murdered the right people? Remember, the brothers in Boston bombing were accused of getting into a shootout with the cops and throwing a pressure cooker bomb at them. We now know that that never happened. The justification for targeting this couple was that supposedly the husband left the meeting disgruntled before the shooting took place. This led an unarmed, unnamed witness to suggest to the police that he might be one of the shooters. Really? You have a dispute at a meeting and then you go home and convince your wife, the mother of a six-month-old baby, to suit up and go on a killing spree? Then you drive home and hang out? If it really happened like this, the fact is that nothing like this has ever happened before in recorded human history, and it defies all common sense. Well, that's an interesting group of questions. Do you think something's rotten in Denmark? Oh, hell no. The news media and the cops and the ruling class tell us the truth all the time. And if you question it, you must be unpatriotic. You must be a communist. Oh, wait a minute. They don't use the communist thing anymore. That's over. They found new words. You're a terrorist.
or the white supremacists talk these people into doing that stuff. It goes along with what Tommy says. Don't trust anybody in power. Cops, politicians, news media, don't trust a goddamn thing they tell you. You ever heard of the name Lloyd Blankenship? Yeah, he's a lucky man. He's the CEO of Massey Energy down there in West Virginia, where they've had as high as 300 violations of safety in the mines, where last few years there were 20-some guys died in the mine because of safety violations. You take him to court now, you'd think that that guy would be given 100 years in the electric chair. But no. You know what he got? Misdemeanor charges. Misdemeanor charges for the willful murder of 23 miners. Like I said before, quit worrying about the common man on the street. Concern yourself with these rats at the top. Here's more about criminal terrorist CEOs of large corporations that are usually responsible for many, 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 many deaths.
Goodman. We're talking about the $900 million settlement that's been reached between the U.S. Justice Department and GM over the deaths of over 124 people, for a faulty ignition switch that they knew about for over a decade. Among our guests today, Laura Christian, mother of Amber Rose. She was 16 years old when she died as a result of this faulty ignition switch in the car, which crashed. Ralph Nader, who's long taken on General Motors, and Rena Steinzor, who wrote the book Why Not Jail? Industrial Catastrophes, Corporate Malfeasance, and Government in Action. Professor Steinzor, can you respond to this settlement and what you think needs to happen? Do you think the government sold out to General Motors?
Yes, I think the government sold out to General Motors, and what it did is part of a much larger trend. The name of this kind of agreement is deferred prosecution agreement, and what that means is that companies can pay a hefty fine that to them is just a cost of doing business and avoid any admission that they committed criminal acts. The U.S. attorney has filed a statement of facts about what happened here that in and of itself is pretty shocking. There were efforts to cover up the ignition switch defect going back as far as 2001. At one point, the GM engineer who was in charge of the switch, Ray DiGiorno, secretly changed the part without telling anybody. And so Cobalt from 2005 and Saturns from 2005 on were safe, but cars were left on the road, hundreds of thousands of them, that still had the faulty switch that GM acknowledged was faulty by changing the part. GM spent years procrastinating. They had various work groups, task forces who sat around palavering about what to do. They still drag their feet when their outside counsel told them they risked punitive damages in some of the tort cases. And finally, they rushed to the Justice Department and said, I'm sorry, and were able to escape without having to plead guilty. This happened most notoriously in the case of HSBC, the huge worldwide bank, which was laundering money for Mexican drug cartel. And the Justice Department gave them the same kind of settlement, deferred prosecution agreement, which is a favorite of the Obama administration's Justice Department and really denies justice to the victims of the bad acts that are covered in a statement but never brought to court.
Professor Steinzor, Ralph Nader mentioned that drivers were prosecuted.
Yes.
Even though General Motors knew it was their fault, they had a faulty ignition switch. Can you tell us some of the stories of those drivers?
Yes. The one that is most vivid in my mind is the case of Candace Anderson, who was driving a Saturn, and she ran the car into a tree after she lost control of it. It's really important to try and focus on how upsetting it is to have a car stall out as you're driving it. You lose the steering, the brakes, the airbags you find once you find out aren't working once you crash, but by then you've already been through this terrible experience. Unfortunately, her fiance was killed in that crash, and she was indicted for reckless homicide. Fortunately, they gave her probation, but not until her parents had emptied their retirement account to pay for her defense. And only years later did a judge vacate her plea when GM admitted that the switch was faulty. So the double standard for white-collar criminals and the average person is revealed in sharp relief by this very sad case.
Let's turn to Samantha Denty of Toms River, New Jersey, describing what happened when she drove a GM car with a faulty ignition switch.
Driving this car was like playing a game of Russian roulette with my safety and that of my friends. I can't even begin to explain the fear and confusion that runs through you that moment when you have no control over your car. I cannot comprehend the loss that these families behind me are going through. My hope is that the horror stops right now. I don't want any more drivers to be mourned by family and friends because an automaker hit a deadly problem. The federal government failed to take action, and drivers like me were kept in the dark.
That's a half an hour show. I cut it short, but you get the message. You get the message. White collar CEOs at the top get away with murder. Murder in all areas of life in this country. All areas of the life. Now, I got to hand it to the Chinese, and I believe this, when they have somebody do something that affects hundreds, thousands of people in China, bad CEOs, they take the bastard out behind the barn and shoot him right between the eyes. I agree with that. I support that. And when you got a government and Justice Department that won't proceed against people like that, well, sooner or later, the people are going to take it into their own hands. Well, we missed the Morris Dees fiasco again. Racism is the subject of the Connecticut Forum this Thursday, December 3rd, at Bushnell at Hartford, Connecticut, which is sold out, an indicator of the topic's importance in light of contemporary events such as the Black Lives Matter More. High-profile white-on-black officer involves shootings and the unrest in Syria that's turned thousands of people into refugees. Morris Dees, one of the panelists and co-founder of the Southern Millionaires Law Center, which has specialized in conning people out of their money cases since its founding in 1971, agrees with the Law Center. Dees has been fighting racist hate groups for decades and has scored some major victories. But the people who were his who hired him, they didn't get crap. In an interview with The Current, Dee says that racism is a seething thing happening, bubbling under the surface since the end of the civil rights movement. That seething boiled up to the surface after the election of the first African-American president, and participation in hate groups boomed, he said. But that was dropped off, he says, because clandestine racist operations have been largely supplanted by the mainstream of hate, mostly prominently in the form of Fox News and Donald Trump. On Fox News, the comments coming out of some people there, it's the same things I've heard these hate groups say all these years ago. Dees says the popularity of Donald Trump is incredible. A politician who said things like that 10 years ago would not be on the ticket, not on the stage. He says things that are demonstrably false. playing on that mainstreaming. It's xenophobia like you've never seen it before, said Morris. If you give me enough money, I'll save you from these people. On Fox News, the comments coming out of some people there, it's the same thing I heard from these hate groups all those years ago. Wait a minute, I just read that. Deese attributes the rise of xenophobia not just to racist backlash against Obama's election and the stream of desperate refugees, but also to the changing demographics of the country. Well, I don't know. Obama, his Justice Department has received a whole lot of racist complaints from students in college, but he's only taken about 25% of them. They've received over 1,500, I believe, complaints, and he's only looked into 25%. I don't think that Obama's that interested. When I first started out in 1960, 15% of the Americans were people of color. Today it's 37%, he says. In 25 years, people of color will be a majority. But you'll be dead, Morris. Texas will be a blue state soon. Whites who have controlled things so long feel that their entitlements are being taken away from them by people who don't look like them and don't think like them. Isn't it amazing how rotten a white man can get? Morris Deese. Yeah. Wait a minute. I lost my place. I lost my place. At Thursday's panel discussion, Deese will share the stage with author Wes Moore, actress, comedian, on The Daily Show correspondent Jessica Williams and Antonio Villagrosa, the former mayor of Los Angeles. The evening will be moderated by Michelle Norris of National Public Radio. There you go. Oh, tickets are $30 to $90. That's to keep the riffraff out, you know. Well, guess what? For the first time since World War II, Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf will be printed in Germany in January as an annotated edition, the Institute Publishing it said Tuesday. The autobiographical text will return to the public domain at the start of the year and hit bookshops between January 8th and the 11th, said Andreas Wersching, director of the Institute of Contemporary History in Munich. Wow. The book, which adds context to the Nazi dictator's hateful rant with some 3,500 annotations, will be published in two volumes totaling 1,948 pages and sold at €59, $62, said Wersching, who's been working on the project since 2009. The first run of Hitler Mein Kampf, a critical edition, would be limited between 3,500 and 4,000 copies, he said. Plans to publish the new version have been controversial and drawn fire, especially from Jewish groups who have argued the book is dangerous and should never be printed again. Wow. But Wersching said the republication of the text with expert commentary aims to shatter the myths surrounding the book, which Hitler wrote in 1924 while languishing in prison after a failed coup. Authorities at the southern state of Bavaria were handed a copyright by the Allied forces after World War II. For 7 decades, they have refused to allow it to be republished out of respect for victims of the Nazis and to prevent incitement of hatred. But now they're all for inciting hatred. But at the end of the year, the copyright runs out so that Mein Kampf, which means My Struggle, falls into the public domain on January 1st. This is not a source for the study of Nazi ideology, said the historian responsible for the project, Christian Hartmann. Quote, it is also a symbol, and it's one of the last relics of the Third Reich. A 95-year-old former medic at the Auschwitz camp is fit to stand trial for at least 3,681 counts of accessory to murder. A German's appeal court ruled Tuesday. Herbert Z. was a medical orderly at the camp between August 15, 44 to September 14, 45, when 14 trains carrying prisoners, including the teenage diarist Anne Frank, arrived at Auschwitz-Birkenau, where many would eventually be killed in the gas chambers, which is a very controversial subject, whether there were gas chambers there or not. I think they've pretty well proven there weren't. Sorry, boys and girls, I hate to tell you, but I found the Hitler's book, Mein Kampf, to be pretty boring myself. Don't shoot me. But I didn't find it to be that exhilarating. I got a lot more out of reading Lenin's book. I ain't no communist, but anyhow, he was a tactician. Most of the stuff in the Mein Kampf is not tactical, you know. It dealt in big generalities. Well, here's a little bit of interesting history. The West German administration wanted experienced officials after World War II and was willing to turn a blind eye to their past. The heads of the ministry had alternatives. German administrators hired by the Allies with no ties to the Nazi Party, or German bureaucrats who fled and returned to the country after the war. But in the end, experience was the only consideration. In other words, they wanted to make money. In fact, over half of the employees at the German Federal Ministry of the Interior founded after World War II were former members of the Nazi Party, according to findings of a study on the early years of influential ministry. Quote, at the time, top-ranking civil servants, people who'd already worked on legal and administrative matters, were usually former members of the Nazi Party, Dr. Friedrich Gunther, one of the researchers, told the newspaper. Since December 2014, researchers of the German Institute for blah, 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 have been going through the personal files dated back to 49 when the West German Ministry was established. Similar projects were conducted at the Ministries of Justice and Foreign Affairs, but this time the conclusions were particularly surprising. Preliminary results of the study scheduled for completion in 2018 show that an average of 54% of the employees hired for the new ministry were former members of the National Socialist German Workers Party. In 1961, two-thirds of the employees had a Nazi past, including 6% who made a direct transition from the Interior Ministry of the Third Reich. Oh, wow. In comparison, the average number of former NSDAP members in other reviewed ministries were no higher than 30%. Quote, we knew there was some continuity, but not to this extent, said Gunther. The results are even more disturbing when you think of how influential this ministry was and still is. It's responsible for everything from public health and culture to homeland security and constitutional matters, unquote. Quote, the fact that these people chose to join the NSDAP when they could have joined any other Nazi organization shows a different degree of consent to Nazi ideology, more than just opportunism, unquote, explained the researcher, who has already found evidence showing how ministry workers use their new positions to preserve old ideas. Interesting. Gunther mentioned, as an example, the head of a camp for displaced persons near Munich, which also housed Jews who had escaped to Israel before the war and chose to return. They were trying to build a new life but were treated as illegals, revealed Gunther. The ministry tried to expel them from the camp and make their life as difficult as possible. It showed no empathy for them, only 10 years after the Holocaust. This is a clear indication that anti-Semitism didn't just stop in 45, but still influenced the politics of the Ministry of Interior. Germany's Justice Ministry has also been examining the extent of Nazi legacy in the country's legal system. To many who bore guilt covered for each other, Justice Minister Heiko Maas recently said in an interview with the Associated Press, even at the start of the 60s, 80% of the judges at the Federal Court of Justice had been judges under the Nazis. That illustrates the extent to which the German justice system failed. The ministry is also reviewing laws containing the terminology that reflects the ideology of the Third Reich. In particular, attention is being paid to the law on murder, which describes perpetrators as those who kill out of bloodlust for the satisfaction of sexual impulse, out of greed, or otherwise lowly motives. This phrasing was formulated in 1941 by Roland Freisler, a former official at the Nazi Justice Ministry and later president of the Nazi Germany's People's Court. Unlike most Nazi-inspired paragraphs on a criminal code, this one wasn't abolished after the war. Professor Jörg Kinzig, director of the Institute of Criminology at Tübingen University, suggests that this paragraph was spared as a part of a compromise, or that the new jurisdiction saw it as a relic of legal tradition predating the Nazis and therefore not contradicted by the law. Over the years, the legal community found its way to circumvent the phrasing, making it somewhat of a dead letter. But Maas insisted that the language of the Nazis has no place in our criminal code, and in June, a special committee submitted a 900-page report unanimously agreeing to abolish the problematic wording. As for the employment of former NSDAP members in the German ministries, Maas says, although probably all these people have passed away, the scientific research can bring up a light new valuable insights into how former elites, amongst them often lawyers, were able to reach again important positions in the new democratic system. Gunther, too, sees his study as a reminder that being a pluralistic society is a constant struggle. Quote, no one can change overnight from a Nazi to a Democrat. No, they could change from a Nazi to a communist. People probably learn about democracy by knowing the international community is watching them closely. While history marks 1949 as a turning point and the date of birth of modern Germany, our study shows that only after 10 to 15 years did people adapt to the new regime and become convinced Democrats. How exactly did they do that is something that we still need to find out. The researchers plan to halt their review when they reach the records of the 70s, but we need to ask ourselves about further continuity of authoritarian thinking in the administration, added Gunther. I don't think there has been any revival, but we still need to be careful and check them out again, because there may be secret Nazis around. Well, it looks to me like Nazis never lost power. They lost quite a bit of power, but they didn't lose all the power. That's about it for today. I'll be back with you on Moon's Day. In the meantime, run for your lives. ISIS is coming to your hometown, man. To be a good American, you must live in fear. Fear, yeah. And give the government plenty of tax money to buy more weapons.
Yeah, Breaker 1-9, this is a rubber duck. You got a copy on Big Big Ben, come on. Yeah, 10-4, Big Ben, for sure. By golly, it's clean, clear to Flagtown, come on. Yeah, it's a Big 10-4 there, Big Ben. Yeah, we definitely got the front door, good buddy. Mercy sakes alive, looks like we've got us a convoy.
Dark the moon on the 6th of June in a Kenworth pulling logs. Cab over Pete with a reefer on and a Jimmy hauling hogs. We is heading for Bear on I-10 about a mile out of Shaky Town. I says, Pigpen, this here's a rubber duck and I'm about to put the hammer down.
Man, I love those convoys.